Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. It's like coffee with an analyst, but there's no actual coffee. Each episode, we interviewed an expert in the field of law enforcement analysis to share their career-defining stories and to get their insights on the world. Please join us on recognizing and learning from these brilliant minds as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Alder, and today our guest has 12 years of law enforcement analysis experience. He's IACA certified analyst and currently the chair of the publications committee for IACA. He's also currently the director of operations for the Canadian Society of Evidence-Based Policing. In 2019, he was selected to be a IACP NIJ lead scholar, one of only two analysts ever to get this designation, and the first from Canada. Coming to us from Saskatoon Police Services, please welcome John Ng. John, how are we doing?
Good, Jason. Thanks for having me.
I really appreciate you being on the show, and it's been a while. We worked together in IACA under, what was that, SMT. So that was Standards, Methods, and Technology. And I don't know about you. I was thinking about this yesterday. That seems like a really long time ago.
Definitely was.
And I don't know why it seems like that long ago, but to me, that just seems like a whole other life. It almost seems like college to me that when we were working together, it's certainly not that long ago, but it feels like.
Yeah. And like you said, when, you know, we've definitely passed by each other at conferences, but it's majority of the time, it's like rush, rush, rush. And it's kind of like, oh, hey, Jason, how's it going? And then that's pretty much about it.
Yeah. All right. So it's great to catch up. Let's get started with the interview. How did you discover the law enforcement analysis profession?
That is a really interesting question. It was actually kind of a little bit by luck. When I finished my master's degree in criminal justice, I had the initial idea that, you know, I wanted to get into my PhD, and I definitely did obviously finish my thesis, and that went relatively okay. Definitely not the best stuff that I've worked on before. But so after I graduated, I was looking for work, and I really had absolutely no idea like what I wanted to do. I really wanted to ultimately get into a position involving research. I had no idea that crime analysis even remotely existed. So I did a few research gigs before I got into law enforcement. I moved from Toronto to Saskatoon because my wife got some work here. I ultimately did a couple of research gigs, like I mentioned, and I got some experience under my belt after grad school, because obviously some of that work experience is necessary to get yourself in the door for policing, for sure. And so I started working in their planning and research unit when I first got hired, and it was a temporary position. Fortunately, the fellow that had that position didn't come back, so I ended up getting hired full-time. And so I just started doing some research-related stuff at the very beginning of my career. But oddly enough, like, I started to get into crime analysis. I can't exactly remember how I started, but what I do remember is that I ended up reading, I think it was Rachel Santos's crime mapping book, and that was the very first textbook that I had, and I'm really glad that that's the book that I started out with, because it's definitely like a highly recommended read for anyone who wants to get started in this field, because it covers pretty much everything in a very easy to understand way. So when I still reference it for my counterparts and colleagues that are just getting into the field. So yeah, I recommend that for them to read. But yeah, and then so the way things kind of progressed was, after I worked as a research coordinator in the planning and research unit, it created a new position called the patrol analyst position. And that was intended to add additional analytical capacity to frontline patrol. We historically have always had a criminal investigations analyst. So this time around, they wanted to create a special constable patrol analyst position. So because of the fact that I think that I'm pretty much like self-trained, I read through every book that I could possibly get. And I started, of course, like applying a lot of those different techniques to the work that I was doing in the planning and research unit. So then when the position came up for a patrol analyst spot, I applied for it and I ended up getting it. So and ever since then, I've been working in the patrol / divisional crime analyst position for, it's like coming up to my 10th year now.
So what were some of the research projects you worked on in the beginning?
Yeah, I mean, so I think that the experiences that I gained at the very beginning was actually very similar to what some analysts experience, because I've done a little bit of research in terms of like what our profession is like. And some folks, apparently a good number of folks, actually experience where they're more supported in almost like a management accountability type of situation where, you know, they end up creating routine kind of reports, like CompSat reports is a primary example, a lot of statistical stuff. So that's kind of what I was really, really working on near the beginning. But I was also asked to do like a couple of evaluations for police initiatives, and that's still to this day of my interest, is helping police agencies improve their practices and developing evaluations and research evidence to help them determine whether or not what they're doing is effective. So it's still something of interest to me, but that's pretty much how it got started, was with a couple of those research projects.
You started as a patrol analyst. So what are some tasks that you're doing specifically for patrol?
Yeah, so to be quite frank, like at the very beginning, the service didn't really know what to do exactly with me, because it was a completely brand new position. And so it gave me a lot of leverage in terms of like what I wanted to do. And so because of my training with ICA, I knew about tactical and strategic crime analysis, but more so this position I felt like was more geared towards the tactical side. So I started applying like a few different techniques, and it really wasn't, I think a lot of people can be quite honest about this, that it wasn't, the culture, I guess, was not receptive to what a new tactical analyst would look like and what crime analysis would look like. They understood what a criminal investigations analyst would be doing in terms of supporting different types of investigations, but doing different types of tactical analysis, identifying crime series, you know, looking for investigative leads, looking at hotspots, helping with the deployment of resources. It was very, very brand new stuff. So progressively, though, there's been gradual changes and, you know, more so changes in the past 3 years or so that I think have really set a standard for the police service. So yeah, that's kind of what I've been doing with the patrol analyst side of things, is more of the tactical analysis work.
When you first said patrol, I was thinking the beats and deployment and that kind of aspect to analysis. What's the data telling patrol how they should run things?
Yeah.
But it sounds like from your perspective, since you were tactical, you're identifying what, some patterns and trends that then help direct patrol?
Yeah, exactly. So historically, because of my move from the planning and research unit, I was very statistically oriented. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of, like I said, confusing, not really clear in terms of like what I was doing on the patrol end of things. So I had to make it my own. And admittedly, at the very beginning of my career, I was very much, I think any senior analyst can attest to this, where they kind of look back at their previous products and wonder like, what was I doing? Like, are you kidding me? Like, this would not be acceptable, like, whatsoever. So yeah, I mean, definitely at the very beginning of my career, I, you know, made some missteps in terms of the products that I was hoping to develop. And I think it was the fact that I was partially educating myself, educating the, you know, senior staff who were, you know, my supervisors, in terms of what crime analysis was really about. Like I said, they're familiar with like the investigative side of things, and but they're not familiar with identifying crime patterns as they kind of move forward, like reading reports every single day and determining, you know, whether certain things are connected to each other. That was very foreign for them.
Now, did you get to the point where you were testing the data, applying a statistical test to the data?
Not in a really complicated way. Mm-hmm. To be quite frank, like I've been working on a research project with some of my colleagues in outside of work. But one thing that we noticed in the recent study that we had done, and it was mainly about what are the work experiences of Canadian crime analysts and the types of analysis that they would be doing. And a good portion of what our analysts were doing, and obviously it wasn't the biggest sample in the world, I can't remember what our sample size was, and we also don't know whether or not it's generalizable, but what we did learn was that a lot of the analytical work that analysts were doing was very descriptive. It didn't get into any of the more causal type work. And you know, developing hypotheses and whether or not we can see whether the data matches like certain types of beliefs that we feel as though it's causing crime, right? It actually never really gets to that point. Like there were very few analysts that were doing things like regression and ANOVA tests, et cetera, like they just weren't doing that a lot of the times. And it was very descriptive, right? Like how many burglaries there were, whether they were up or down in terms of like percentage changes is very descriptive. So that's kind of the extent of the statistical type work that I would really be doing for patrol. And I think part of it comes down to really like, what does patrol really need? Does it really need the fancy, complicated types of math? And do we really need to express any of that stuff? Or do we have the tools to work on that? Do we have the time to work on it? Do we have the resources? All of that has been, you know, obviously challenging because I was like the first analyst to engage in all that stuff. And we're still kind of working our way through that process. But as I said, the research that I've done before in the past in terms of like reading more about our profession and engaging in research studies that I'm doing right now, it seems like a lot of the analysts out there doing very descriptive work.
There's no quicker way to lose a police audience than start talking about significance tests, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
It reminds me one time at a Comstat at Baltimore Police Department when I was there, the one major just kept talking about the stats and how it was significantly high.
Yeah.
And he kept using the word significant. And it was funny from my point of view because everybody in the audience was with the police department. It was either sworn or civilian. There wasn't any academics there, but I was always thinking, I was like, man, if there's an academic here, they would be cringing that you're using the word significant and data and no testing is going on at all.
Yeah. And I think that's where, if there's any one thing that I would probably recommend to both analysts and also like their supervisor and supervisors, and I think policing as a whole, I think the one thing that I learned from a recent research study on data quality that I did with some of my colleagues is the fact that data literacy, especially in the age that we're in with, you know, advances in computers, the volume of data that we're dealing with, data literacy is so big because there's got to be both a balance between analysts knowing what the data really means. And then, but then on the other side, it requires like sworn staff to know what to ask their analysts. And if they don't understand what the data means, if there's like a 200% increase in a certain type of crime, like people start losing their minds over that. It's like, if you actually look at the actual change, it might actually be very minimal. But I mean, without that data literacy and what some of the caveats are associated with data and data quality and what all of that means, it's just going to be a lot of misinformation that's out there. So I think it's really important for both civilian and sworn staff to be knowledgeable about the data that goes in, the analysis that comes out, and what some of this means. So
in general, then, do you think most officers, they understand the data and they understand what they're looking at and they understand how to access it, right? What seems to be the deficiency?
There's a couple of things. The study that my colleagues and I did in terms of data quality, it also spoke about data access as well. And the fact that, you know, there's a few things. Number one is the, I guess, the quality of the data systems that we currently have, and the fact that, you know, officers need to ultimately, in some cases, like do multiple entries of the exact same thing. So we end up like dealing with issues of data quality. But in terms of the access part of it, it may come down to, you know, the analysts not having tools that they could use to access types of data, but also for them to be able to gather data from various data systems and recognizing that, you know, there may be discrepancies between like multiple systems. So there's definitely a lot of those different types of discrepancies that are out there. And so we've just got to be able to create some type of something that my colleagues and I kind of refer to as data governance. So the question that we had for our respondents was, are there any data structures or data quality structures, policies and procedures at your workplace that, you know, governs how data is being entered in, how it's being coded, who checks for any of the data quality, all of that stuff? Majority of our respondents said that there's absolutely no data governance process within their police agency, which is really odd because policing is well known for policy and procedure. You know, we've got to follow specific types of rules within policing and how we do certain things. And yet I would argue that we don't have anything like that for the most part when it comes down to data quality. So that's definitely a huge thing that's missing.
In the States here, we have regulations on crime in terms of either the UCR or NIBRS.
Right.
That, in a sense, is at least some level of data governance, isn't it?
Right. It is. And Canada does have a UCR code governance practice. But the difference is that for us, and I know that with your move to NIBRS, like it's definitely much more detailed in terms of what the data is being captured. But the UCR code up here in Canada is very similar to what you guys have to submit. But the problem is that that's just for like crime categories. We're not talking about like additional things like, you know, addresses or times or any of the additional like nice stuff that analysts would love to have. There's no governance structure that ensures any of that stuff is standardized. So in terms of, you know, crime categories, yes, I would agree. Canada has something like that that helps determine some level of quality, but the rest of it is pretty much free game. Like it's open. But that being said as well, what I would also say is that relative to systems like in the UK, I don't think so more in the US, but for sure in the UK, they've got a national intelligence model, which is like a national framework on how, you know, their intelligence systems work. And that includes like data quality. And we don't have anything like that within Canada. We don't have a general framework on intelligence. So that's one big thing that we're definitely missing.
Yeah. And I'm sure there's definitely some opportunities there for a department to have data governance, especially if you're dealing with data that isn't part of the UCR.
Right.
And you're reporting on it. And that gets into when I'm trying to think of a good example. You know, if you were talking about
the way you're defining the data. So if you're defining your data in your report different from what is normally defined, maybe you're excluding a certain crime type or you're excluding a region in your report, data governance would dictate how that is handled.
Basically, data governance, for those that may be unfamiliar with data governance, it's basically ensuring that everybody's using the right terms.
Right.
When you use something like significance, for instance, that has the same meaning throughout the workplace. And right. So you don't have a report out there and you're looking at a report and you're like, okay, well, how is that being defined? If you're going to use this term, this is what it means, basically.
Right. I mean, maybe it's not the same type of example, but I mean, I know a lot of instances where date and time occurred for the offense is very different from the date and time that it was reported. And yet a number of different times I've experienced that officers don't understand the difference between the two of them, or it's just that, you know, they may not necessarily be cognizant that there should be a difference majority of the time. That difference is actually really important when we're doing analysis.
Sure. And that is a very good example, because if you could have the two same reports on robbery, for instance, and get totally different numbers, could have the same look and feel, you could have listed the same date range and from the same department, and all the criteria be the same, except one of the reports uses time of the incident and the other one uses time reported.
Yeah. So, and prime example is if you have an analyst that doesn't recognize or understand that that's the difference, they may end up, you know, analyzing date in which it was reported, which really doesn't help you identify when the robbery series was actually happening. Right. Mm-hmm. So if you don't know the difference between the two of them, again, like it could be, you could have a very junior analyst that doesn't know the difference between the two of them and end up reporting something that's completely off. And if you have supervisors that don't know the difference and to ask those kind of hard questions, again, that's where data literacy needs to be important for both sides of the house, right? Not just for the analyst, but also for the supervisors to ask those kind of questions.
Well, I do want to get into some of the projects that you've worked on over the years. So, and this leads us to the analyst badge story. Which, if you're new to the show, the analyst badge story is the career-defining case or project that an analyst works on. The one that you wanted to discuss today is the methodology that you were able to come up with in terms of offender management.
Right. So I don't know if I've got like a solid methodology, but the thing that I've slowly started to recognize is the importance that this is gaining a lot of traction on, because I even know with the United Kingdom's, their Society of Evidence-Based Policing, whenever they've had their conference, one of the main streams that they end up talking about is offender management, which I thought was quite interesting that, you know, out of all the different topics that could show up at an evidence-based conference, they're talking about, you know, how police agencies can better maximize the resources to target specific individuals, right? And it's the same thing with how we deal with crimes in general space. We look at hotspots versus, you know, all the crimes that we could deal with. So it's interesting that, you know, that's become like a really, really hot topic. And so a few years back, I was working, of course, with the method subcommittee that you and I were working on. And I was tasked at that point with coming up with a paper that would be of interest to me. And I was working, I still am participating on our burglary task force here in Saskatoon. The thing that I observed, you know, sitting at this table was that a lot of the individuals that were sitting at the table were speaking just randomly about individuals that they felt as though, based off of their gut sense, that these are individuals that we should focus our attention on. And yet, obviously, as an analyst, like I felt like there needs to be justification as to why we need to focus resources on these individuals, not just because, you know, for instance, one of the main tools that we end up using are curfew checks. So court imposed conditions that say, you know what, this offender needs to be in their house between time X and time Y, just because the person has a specific actionable curfew or even a warrant doesn't mean that we need to target that individual, because there's plenty of other offenders out there that could technically be at very high risk for reoffending, and yet we're, you know, targeting people at random. So I felt as though there needs to be justification for the methodology for how we're picking individuals to focus our resources on. And so I sent out a survey at the very beginning when I was trying to, you know, learn about this a little bit more. And I learned that there actually wasn't a standardized way for police agencies to identify their, you know, prioritizing their offenders. And so I did a little bit more research, and obviously there's, you know, different ranking schemes. I spoke to a number of different subject matter experts. They spoke about ranking schemes. They talk about like weighting for certain types of variables. So just as a really, really simple example, not only would you identify individuals who have committed, you know, a number of, let's say, violent crimes, and you score them, you know, from highest to lowest. So the person at the very, very top has, let's say, like 15 assaults, and the person at the bottom has like one assault. That's the history of assault is not the only factor that needs to be considered when you're identifying whether or not you need to prioritize that individual. There's got to be like multiple different factors. And so the ranking methodology that different police agencies have used, for instance, might include the number of days between, you know, the current date versus their previous offense. If it's been recent, obviously that person we should be focusing in on. If their last assault was from like 10 years ago, obviously that person we're not going to prioritize. But if they've offended very recently, then yeah, we should focus our attention. So there's different types of methodologies, but then I extended that a little further. And fortunately, I've got a really good colleague of mine here who's a clinical psychologist, and her background is in corrections. And so she taught me a little bit about corrections and how they go about identifying at-risk individuals, because that's the whole point of corrections is we want to keep people who are at very high risk for reoffending in custody. So we got discussing a little bit about some of the risk assessment tools that are available for corrections. And so I asked her a little bit more about it. And the way that corrections started out in terms of, you know, risking or assessing people's level of risk initially was exactly the way that most police agencies would probably do it, is you look at the person's name, and it's based off of clinical, you know, professional opinion as to whether or not that person we should really dedicate resources to. And that was the experience that I was dealing with. Subsequent, though, to that, they created more tools that were a little bit more structured. So that was kind of like stage two for corrections. And then stage three for corrections was about having more rigorous, scientifically validated risk assessment tools. And so right now, the way that those risk assessment tools are being used in policing is very minimal, which is a really interesting topic that if anyone wants to look further into, they can. Essentially, what we want to do is create an operational version of some of these risk assessment tools that can be like 30 items long. And yeah, if you're a clinical psychologist and you're working with an offender who's behind bars, you've got time to do that risk assessment, but you need to create something that's operational for frontline staff or even anyone in policing. And so the main studies that are being done in terms of risk assessment has primarily dealt with domestic violence. So we want to identify individuals who are at very high risk for committing another domestic violence incident. So that's great that, you know, a lot of time and effort has been dedicated to that. But the work that I'm doing right now, and we're talking about my badge story, I had worked with my current supervisor to create almost like an intelligence-led approach to identifying our offenders for his unit, which used to be the burglary unit. He's now moved over to be my supervisor. But when him and I initially were partnering together for 2 to 3 years, we wanted to drive the burglary task force towards something that was much more intelligence-driven versus, you know, hey, that guy's got a curfew, let's target our resources towards that guy. And obviously, my supervisor, he just felt like we were spinning our tires because we weren't actually doing anything that was substantial, that was actually reducing crime. So we started developing, you know, intelligence products, backgrounds on individuals, and also creating our bread and butter, which is the tactical crime analysis bulletin, right? That concept actually never existed up until like 3 years ago. And I've been with the service now for almost 12 years. And so that concept never existed until like 3 years ago. So we started really changing the way that the service started running, and we started producing a lot of these tactical bulletins, which has been helpful for investigations, interviews with offenders. A couple of prime examples is, you know, we've been able to identify specific individuals for multiple, like a series of different types of crimes, which historically we wouldn't have gotten that chance because no one was actually paying attention to whether or not the same offender would show up in multiple video stills. The other half of it was the other success story that I would have is I created a tactical bulletin and the investigator picked that up. And when the individual got arrested, they basically presented this product to the offender and said, like, is this you? And he looked at all the photos and he basically admitted, yeah, that's me, like all of them. But without that package of information to present towards the offender, we would have been scrambling to figure out, you know, you're responsible for this one, you're responsible for that one, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, we ended up actually taking photos of people and their clothing when they came in. So we ended up like tying them back to previous files, but without any of that process, without focusing in on analytical products and developing intelligence on people, like we would have done stuff that's very reactive. But now we're moving towards like much more intelligence-led kind of approaches, part of which includes looking at and prioritizing our offenders using a methodology of like using risk assessments is actually evidence-based. It's been, you know, 20 years worth of research within corrections that have validated some of these risk assessment tools. So it's been rigorously studied that we could apply these risk assessment tools for domestic violence. So if any police agency wants to really prioritize who their top domestic violence individuals who are out there, you don't need to guess at to who these individuals should be. You have tools that are easily available to you. So that's kind of what my badge story is. It's a bit of a process, but like I said, it's setting a standard for the way that police agencies are running. And I'm really hoping that in the near future, we'll be able to present on a tool that we've developed for violent offenders within a geographic area that's known to be like a very high violent area in the city. And we're applying that to the offenders who live in that area. So I'm really hoping to create a methodology that way in the very near future and present that maybe at the ISCA for sure, and maybe at some evidence-based policing conferences. So my boss feels as though, and I would agree with him, that we've definitely started something that could be beneficial for a lot of people.
Was there anything that you saw when you looked at the corrections risk assessments where they put weight on something that surprised you?
Yeah, so When I first started out, and I think a lot of police agencies already do this, I don't fault them for doing it because it's actually one of the easiest ways. They just simply rely on the data that they have in their RMSs, right? But in order to accurately predict whether or not a person's going to reoffend down the road, you don't just look at their age, you don't look at their criminal history, you don't look at just the number of charges that they're engaged in. So that's what they would consider, like in corrections terms, they would consider those static factors. So things that you can't technically change, you can't change a person's age, you can't change the person's gender, for instance. And in some cases, that's obviously something that's could be something that, you know, could put them at higher risk. Their age demographics, for sure. Socioeconomic status, that's a difficult thing to potentially change. But there's something called like dynamic risk factors, which includes like, you know, drug use, their involvement with like gangs, social supports, mental health supports, et cetera, et cetera. So if you think about it, an individual who might be at very, very high risk for reoffending, if you differentiate between a person who's obviously got very high risk, but they have good supports versus a person who's got no supports, obviously the person who's got no supports is going to be much more higher risk to reoffend. So that's where we need to consider additional variables that we don't technically have in our police departments. Perhaps I've heard of research studies by Chris Henning and one of our well-known colleagues, Greg Stewart at Portland, and they've tried to automate some of their domestic violence work. And I read a recent study that they published on, and a lot of the data that they ended up using for their risk assessment tool that they built in-house was all stuff that they were already capturing. So it really depended on the police agency willing and interested in capturing pieces of data. So yeah, we could definitely heavily rely on the stuff that we currently have. But if your agency is going to prioritize a certain type of offense, like domestic violence, you need to add on additional variables that you need to start looking further into.
So you mentioned that you're currently working on an offender program where it sounds like a pretty specific area in the city with a very specific group in mind. And right. I found that interesting just because normally when I hear people talk about an offender program, it's like this wide net that they're casting. And right. What they're really sounds like they're looking for is like, okay, give me a top 10 list to target.
Right.
The whole city. Like, who should we be focusing on out of the whole city? But what you talked about is a very specific area there. Do you think most police departments that it's I wouldn't say it's a wrong, but it's not the best practice to look for something where it's casting a wide net throughout the city to come up with something like a top 10 list?
Yeah, exactly. I think if you were to tie it back to geography, it might be a little bit better. I think the methodology that we ended up using actually doesn't include something like race, for instance, right? So when we developed this methodology, we could technically justify it, for instance, to the Board of Police Commissioners, and they could say, you know what, are you really using a standardized method, or are you, you know, randomly picking individuals? And someone could come back and say, you know what, you're just picking on a specific minority group, when really the methodology that we're using does not take into account the person's race whatsoever. So we do have a standardized kind of method, and it doesn't depend on, you know, I could technically, yeah, obviously when I'm scoring the individual, I see their names, but that doesn't play into, we've got a standardized method that we all agreed upon. So when I'm going through these different variables, I'm scoring it based off of something that we all agreed upon. And not only that, but there's inter-rater reliability. So it's not just me scoring the person, but it's someone else scoring it as well. So, you know, we ensure that the individuals that we're picking, there's some kind of rigorous method behind it. And I would agree with you, like in terms of identifying individuals across the whole city, really, what is the purpose? Like how do you go about measuring whether you're successful or not, right? You can measure for sure whether or not the person's going to commit like another crime within the next 6 months, but you could technically tie that back to geography and to say, you know what, because we focus on these individuals, we ended up reducing crime in this hotspot. So that's like another way of targeting issues related to a specific hotspot, right? Because people have to live somewhere. So
now, those list of variables that you mentioned, is that something that is open to the public that you guys publish out?
Yeah, we technically could. The version that we're creating right now is based off of, it's almost like a, like I said, a lot of police agencies, they don't have like a shortened version of some of these risk assessments. A lot of these risk assessments are very labor intensive. So we ended up creating like a screening tool, like a shortened version of something that's rigorously tested already. And the thing that it's done for us is that it's actually helped us identify individuals who are at very high risk for reoffending. And we noticed that there is an ability for this tool to distinguish people who are at low versus high risk. So if we were to grab a list of 30 people, there actually is, you know, a group of individuals who are scoring very, very high. And then there's another group that's scoring very, very low. So it's not like everyone gets piled into the high risk category. There's an ability to distinguish our different groups of people.
Well, let's take a break. When we come back, let's talk a little bit more about evidence-based policing. Talk a little bit about IACA, get your advice, and then we'll talk about some personal interests you got.
Sure.
You're listening to Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. We'll be right back.
This is Emmanuel James Teng, and I invite you to visit leapodcasts.com on the second and fourth Thursday of the month, starting from 12th November. I've joined with ACIA and LEA Podcasts to present our Africa series of podcasts. We aim to bridge understanding between Africa and the rest of the analytical world. With shared thought and a common lexicon, we aim to broaden our analysts' worldviews, mitigate cognitive bias, refine analytical tradecraft, and improve investigative outcomes everywhere. Analysis improves through exchange.
What's going on, analysts? My name is Manny San Pedro. I'm the technology director for the IACA. And here is my public service announcement for analysts. Don't become overly reliant on Excel. Use it to analyze and break down your data. It's a fantastic tool. Fantastic. And it's free as part of the Microsoft Office offering. But don't use it as a database. Use a database as a database. Connect to the database with Excel. And then use it for your pivoting, for all your slicing and dicing, even developing your dashboard. But again, don't use Excel for everything because it may not be the best tool for you.
Welcome back. John, before we get on the next topic, I do want to commend you. You really have your ear to the research going on outside of the police service. That isn't something that I feel a lot of analysts do. There are analysts out there that their whole world is just what's in the police department.
Right.
And yeah, they're not really venturing too far outside their police department unless they absolutely have to. Right. And here you have totally embraced research and ideas. You know, you've already mentioned about what's going on in the States, what's going on in the UK, what's going on in different parts of the world, and how you can bring them back to your police service. So I definitely want to commend you on that.
Thanks.
So let's get into some of the work that you're doing for evidence-based policing. So I do want to talk about the analyst role. And sure, from your point of view, some of the biggest issues that we are seeing with evidence-based policing.
What I'll do is I'll roll back into some of my history in terms of like how I got onto this topic. So a few years back, I was taking a personal leave of absence. And like I said, I graduated with a master's in criminal justice. I had absolutely zero idea that there was policing research that was out there. I had met the founder of the Canadian Society of Evidence-Based Policing, Dr. Laura Huey, who is at Western University. She's since like stepped away from CANSEP. But at that point, we had discussed about different types of policing research that existed. So I got my hands on Dr. Larry Sherman or Lawrence Sherman's paper on evidence-based policing. And I think it was with the Police Foundation. His paper was in 1998, I believe. He wrote this paper that basically suggested that part of police decision-making should not just be based off of personal experience, which is very valid and important, but it should also be based off of research methodology. And the reason for that is because it may be the case that a single officer has a specific type of experience. The bigger question is, what is really effective within policing, right? So if we take a single officer and their experience, can we generalize that knowledge of what's considered an effective practice? Can we share that across the whole police department and say, you know what, this is the method that's going to help us reduce crime? I don't know if we could necessarily do that with a single officer's perspective, and that's the problem-ish. I say that with a caveat because one of the main things I think a lot of people misunderstand about evidence-based policing is the fact that I've heard this on multiple occasions, is that the research evidence that's out there right now, it's specifically applicable to, let's say, the US or the UK, and it can't be applicable to, let's say, Canada, for instance, right? One of the main key principles behind evidence-based policing is called the three T's, and that's Sherman's idea of targeting, testing, and tracking. So it's very similar to the way that you would conceive a problem right into policing. You would identify what the problem is, you would implement a solution, and then you would evaluate whether or not it's been effective, right? Very similar to the way POP does it. So what this does with this 3T concept is that it encourages police officers, police agencies, and analysts to start creating research evidence that's contextual and it's jurisdictional. So yeah, it may be the case that hotspot policing, 20 years worth of research has demonstrated that hotspot policing, another approach like focused deterrence, and another approach like problem-oriented policing have all been effective to demonstrate reductions in crime and disorder. But someone might say, you know what, okay, let's try hotspot policing. We know that it works. It's definitely going to work in, let's say, Saskatoon. But without specific research evidence to show that it works within Saskatoon and actually run a study to demonstrate that it works, it's just an idea that's out there. And we really need to start like using analysts to develop some of the research evidence that's within your own jurisdiction. I've started to do that. And part of that comes down to even demystifying some ideas that might be out there. For instance, like I've got a colleague of mine that studied whether or not does crime increase or decrease when there's a full moon that's out there, right? So a lot of people would say, you know what, crime's going to go crazy when there's a full moon. But if you actually run a research study, there's actually no truth to that. So, but that's what I mean by looking at some of these ingrained myths within policing and identifying whether or not that's true. And again, it's not because it's been done in, you know, New York. It's not because it's been done in LA. It's because it's been actually done within your city and it's based off of your current data. So a study that I recently ran, and again, it's like this myth thing that I wanted to study, was whether or not there is a relationship between temperature and the incidence of stolen vehicles. Because some would suggest that with colder weather, that there's more people leaving their vehicles running and therefore there's a higher incident of stolen vehicles. And yet, if we understand the crime triangle, you need to have an attractive target, you've got to have a motivated offender, and you've also have to have a lack of guardianship. So if it's cold out, yes, there is, you know, attractive target out there, someone's leaving their vehicles running, but if it's like minus 50 below, are you really going to have an offender that's out there that's going to be targeting these vehicles? The answer is no. But that's because you understand, you know, that you're using science and you're using criminological theory to understand, you know, what's creating that opportunity and whether or not, you know, some type of crime phenomenon is actually true or not. So the reason why I'm passionate about all of this is the fact that I feel as though analysts have the opportunity to really study whether or not something is true within the police agency and not just going through the same kind of motions over and over and over again. We could actually, you know, study whether something's true or not. So then we could help our police agencies say, you know what, this is an effective practice. Let's continue doing it. Otherwise, let's scrap this kind of specific type of initiative. And the reality is that we're dealing with multiple different types of crises in policing right now in terms of trust and legitimacy with the public. We're dealing with financial issues. We're also dealing with COVID. So we've got multiple different types of pressure within police departments right now. And the more rigorous research that we could demonstrate, not just I'm talking about as a general whole, but if we had analysts like focus in on identifying effective practices within their own police jurisdiction, they could say, for instance, to a police board that helps provide funding and also other external partners to say, you know what, according to our research, this is an effective practice. And that's the reason why we're doing something like this. Or alternatively, they wanted to start something new and recognize that it's not working and say, you know what, we're actually creating more harm than good, then we're scrapping this. But without that study, whether or not we're being effective or not, we're just wasting public dollars and we're could potentially like risking public trust and legitimacy. And we could also be creating issues with more crime and more victimization. So that's the reason why I feel strongly that analysts have the opportunity to generate research that's within their jurisdiction to identify whether or not what they're actually doing is making a difference.
Now, is there, I guess for lack of a better term, blueprints out there or recipes an analyst can follow that, okay, I'm interested, but I'm not sure where to start. Is there tools out there to help somebody get started?
Yeah, absolutely. So not to be like a shameless bit of a plug, but I'm working on a book right now, a couple of book chapters, and it's specifically dedicated to crime analysts. And one of them talks about struggles for analysts and the challenges that we deal with working within policing. And then there's another part of it that talks about like successful practices. So hopefully that's coming out in the near future. So that's something that our colleagues can take a peek at once it comes out. But there's a few other, if you simply look at on Amazon, you type in, you know, evidence-based policing, there's plenty of research that's out there on how to implement different types of evidence-based practices. The other thing that I would highly recommend analysts to look at, and even police leaders, would be looking at the stratified policing model that Dr. Rachel and Roberto Santos recently, not recently, but they created. And that's basically a structured methodology for implementing crime analysis at various levels of police service and also how to implement evidence-based practices. So that's definitely like a really, really good start. I would also recommend different analysts to start participating within different society of evidence-based policing that's out there. So there's the US, the UK, Australia, New Zealand, and within Canada. So there's plenty of different societies to be part of. And there's tons of members like all around the world. We're talking about thousands of members that are involved in this process. So you've definitely got people to rely on. But two additional resources that I would also recommend, it's the George Mason Center for Evidence-Based Crime Policy. And they've got the evidence-based policing matrix that Dr. Cynthia Lum created. And I think Dr. Cody Tellup developed it as well. So there's definitely that resource, which if analysts were to look at a specific type of problem and they could look at that website to see whether or not there's research that's been done on a specific topic and whether or not there's an effective practice associated with dealing with that crime and disorder problem. Related to that, of course, is the POP website. So the Center for Problem-Oriented Policing, that's another great resource. The last one related to the George Mason one is the College of Policing in the UK. They've got a very, very similar type of tool. Again, it's about looking at what research studies that have existed and what their level of rigor is for studying that specific phenomenon and that type of initiative to deal with that problem.
It seems to me that there's certain aspects of evidence-based policing that I think is better accepted than others. And I find it fascinating that there's certainly you get a good bit of pushback with some of this stuff. But there are there's plenty of success stories out there. And one of the things that I find fascinating over looking at the way cities do different things, and I'm sure it was based on evidence-based policing, is how to handle traffic, especially when it comes down to large events. I remember as a kid, geez, you would leave a large venue and you'd be sitting in traffic for what seemed like hours. Mm-hmm. And now it seems like a lot of cities have got it figured out. They'll close down streets. They'll get everybody going one direction and you're getting out. You're right. Pushing everybody out away from that event. Why do you think that there's some things that is embraced from evidence-based policing and then there's some stuff that gets pushed back?
Yeah, that's actually a really, really interesting topic. So one of my key interests in police research as a whole is about organizational change and also culture. So there's plenty of studies out there that look at various factors about policing culture and about policing practice and about, you know, certain things about policing that either promote or hinder the adoption of evidence-based policing. One of the things I kind of learned from the two book chapters that I've been helping to write is that I learned that two things. Number one, police officers obviously will adopt practices that are at low risk. So they won't change certain types of police practices just because a certain study says so, because it could end up like they're working with police funding and also politics, and they can't drastically change a certain kind of process just because of a certain kind of study that was out there or they want to experiment with something. So I absolutely agree with them, and they should be taking like low risk if they really want to adopt something. The other thing I learned about policing when it comes down to evidence-based policing is that a lot of officers, like we had talked about at the very beginning of our conversation here, is there's different levels of research methodology, some more rigorous than other ones. And officers are more likely to accept types of research that are less complicated, less rigorous, But in my perspective, even though you've got like less rigorous methods, if you've got like 20, 50 studies that say the exact same thing, but you don't have the greatest rigor to all of your research, it still says something in my perspective. The last thing that I learned was officers are much more accepting of things like hotspot policing and of problem-oriented policing, because in both of those incidences, the thing that absolutely drives them nuts is when they have a lack of autonomy to do what they need to do. If you had an analyst that said, hey, you know what, Joe officer, according to my analysis, you need to be in this specific hotspot and you can't go anywhere else because otherwise you're not going to be reducing crime and disorder. Like, you're reducing the autonomy that officers have, and they've got plenty of useful knowledge that's out there. So we can't discount any of that stuff. So I think as long as we're, you know, respecting where officers are coming from, as long as we're flexible in terms of understanding, you know, the risks that they have to deal with and the challenges and the types of decisions that they have to make, and respecting the fact that they're dealing with politics and the public, I think there's definitely going to be better receptivity if we were to respect all of those different pieces.
Very good. So John was just a co-author on an article published in the Police Journal, Theory, Practice, and Principles, called Evidence-Based Policing and Analysis. So we'll put a link to that article. Highly suggest that you check that out. John, I'm going to move on now. Let's talk a little bit about the IACA. As mentioned, you are the chair of the Publications Committee. What is the Publications Committee up to, and what's coming up next?
For sure. Historically, the main thing that the Publications Committee is known for is obviously the main textbook that we all learn and study from, especially for certification. And we're also known for, you know, obviously some of the research papers that are previously published and some additional types of resources. But the main thing that I wanted to do as chair was to reset the way that our membership recognized the Publications Committee. And I ultimately, at the very end of the day, I ultimately want our membership to recognize that the Publications Committee is there to be a resource for our membership. But in addition to that, to promote not only our membership and our profession within like ourselves, but I also want that to be promoted to police leaders and also to the public. The public, especially because they're the ones that could potentially say, hey, you know what, why are you not using, you know, crime analysis to identify when is the most frequent time of day and day of week for a certain type of crime? Or, you know, are you using your crime analyst to help deploy resources, et cetera, et cetera. So that's where the pressure can come from the public. Police leaders also need to be obviously educated about what types of crime analysis products are available and the different types of skills that their analysts have. It helps, again, obviously, with identifying usable products and also useful and meaningful tasks that our analysts can be working on. So I want our publication committee to ultimately be a resource to the world. I would say not just to our membership and provide resources to everyone, but also recognizing that there's different types of media that we could technically exploit. So I would love down the road for our publications committee to start working towards social media and also, you know, things like podcasts, like promoting some of those ones, and also with like webinars that we might end up like wanting to create down the road. So just looking at like different types of media is something that I would ultimately want to produce. And even creating our newsletter, which has been phenomenal. Like the biggest compliment that we ended up getting recently was from Christopher Bruce. And we all know Christopher Bruce. And he had basically said the very first publication that we had sent out for Insights, which is our newsletter, he said that that was probably the best newsletter he's ever seen in the entire history that he's been with the ICA. So for us, that was a huge compliment from someone of his, with his tenure with the ICA. So again, like I applaud my team for the fantastic work that they've done. And part of it comes down to recognizing what the membership really needs. So again, it's just staying in tune with what our membership needs and providing that information to them, being a resource for everyone.
Is there talk at least about the fourth edition to the textbook coming up anytime soon?
That is a fantastic question. There has been talk. We've done edits to the textbook, and we would love to push some of that out in the next couple of years I'm thinking of. But the other thing that I would love to have is for, selfishly from my side, I would love to have a chapter on evidence-based policing. any other additional chapter that might be useful for policing, like in 2021 and moving on into the future, right? So there's definitely additional skill sets that I think will be important for a subsequent fourth edition. So in terms of the edits, we've already got all of that set down. And we also would love to create like a digital version of that book, right? So before we make any additional steps, we've got to have like a few things in place. So, but yeah, there are plans in place to get that revised.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if you guys were all scared off of that, because the last committee, once they were done with the book, they all resigned from their positions. So I wasn't sure, like, hey, maybe it's cursed now. So it's good to hear that there's talk of a fourth edition.
Yep, for sure.
And then if you have any ideas for John in terms of IACA publications, you can email him at publications@iaca.net. Good deal. And I guess, so speaking of IACA and you being from Canada, I always like to talk about how IACA and even a lot of the other associations too, ILEA, they're all international, but the United States has such a heavy impact on both of those associations. So from your perspective, what would you like the IACA to do more of in order to be more international?
I think for sure we've got a lot of the different stepping stones in place. The idea that our international outreach committee is doing amazing work in terms of even creating the opportunity for different countries to participate in some shape, way, or fashion, and also being active. So it's not just saying that we're willing and interested to, hear what the international community is saying, but like actively working on it day in, day out, and having dedicated members from those specific countries to provide feedback. And I know that the chairs and the different leaders within those different groups are very much constantly working tirelessly towards making sure that the ICA is becoming more international. I mean, I would absolutely agree. And I know a few of our international members have definitely been pushing towards hoping to have some members at like a leadership level to be more international, and hats off to the IACA for having someone like myself, be chair for publications. And I know, there's definitely more Canadians that are on board, like Manny is another one for technology. Mm-hmm. So we've definitely got much more representation from different countries than from my previous years of experience. So yeah, I think we're definitely moving in the right direction.
Two ideas that I have. One is I think the IOC chair should be made into a executive board position to encourage there always be international representation on the board. And I also would, and I'm not sure exactly how this would work out, but in theory, I'd like to see if a country like Canada, for instance, if you have so many members with mm-hmm. the IACA,
yeah,
then you get representation on the board as well.
Right.
I'm sure there's a lot of logistics to that. I'm sure there's a lot of people cringing like that. Like, how would you even pull that off? Like, what would the numbers be? But I do feel that, if there is enough membership from that particular location, that mm-hmm. then they should have representation on the executive board. And so, and to try to get more influence.
Yeah, I would agree on that point. I think with any other type of association, like it's challenging to have a group represented when it's difficult to have someone on the board when, if we don't have enough people voting with, a specific country. And I know, there's been a few challenges in terms of elections over the past couple of years or so, but I think also having someone, like you said, at the executive level from various countries would be helpful. Ever since that I've been, a member for the past, a decade or so, I don't remember. I know that I put my hat in at one point, a few years back, but obviously that didn't work out. But yeah, I would hope that at some point down the road that we would have someone that's not within the US be a member of the executive group. And I don't know if Manny is necessarily, but I mean, he's definitely, you know, one person who's been part of the top leadership for the IEC. So that's definitely a very, very good start.
So there's two people that comes to mind. Currently, Rachel Carson is VP of membership.
Yep.
I think that is. Yep. And then when I first started with the IACA back in 08, mm-hmm. Roman West from Australia was on mm-hmm. the executive board. I think those are the only two that I can think of off the top of my head.
Right.
All right. Well, let's get into some advice for the audience. So probably deals with evidence-based policing, but I won't spoil it too much. But what is something an analyst can study today that's going to be important 5 years from now?
I think you're right. It's definitely evidence-based policing. But that being said, I've definitely recognized that it's not everyone's cup of tea, right? If we look at everyone, there's individuals who love doing the day-to-day tactical stuff, and they absolutely love, you know, helping with investigations. And I'm not going to take away from any of that stuff. But I think a lot of people have recognized that there's been a lack of strategic crime analysis that's been done in many police agencies. It's very heavily tactically oriented. And again, it's really whether or not it's your cup of tea. But my belief is that moving on into the future, it's just going to be that much harder for police agencies to justify what they're doing. And simply increasing their arrest numbers and not justifying, you know, how much money they're spending and constantly asking for additional money, and also identifying best practices on how to increase trust and legitimacy, all of that stuff, it's not arrest driven. Like in some cases, like we don't know whether or not, for instance, applying like a hard law enforcement kind of approach to a hotspot project might not necessarily be helpful and useful to you. And ultimately, people just want to feel safer. So I think that's the ultimate like end goal for police agencies, to do it, you know, to reduce crime, make people feel safer, do it in a legitimate way and in a fiscally responsible type of way, I think is essentially what a lot of people would want from their police agency. And I just feel as though there's greater capacity for analysts to do something like that. But like I said, there's some analysts that are just, that's just not their cup of tea, and that's perfectly fine. But the folks who are interested in wanting to do something a little bit different, I would highly encourage them to pay attention to what evidence-based policing has to say and to identify what their role is and participate. Because amongst all of the different types of literature that I've learned about our profession, one of the things I would highly argue for in one of the book chapters that I'm writing is that analysts truly have an informal leadership capacity. So we talk a lot about leadership within policing as being associated to rank. But the reality is that there are plenty of, like, leadership truly is about influence. And if you think about analytical work, that's ultimately what we want to do. And we're hopefully doing on a day-in-day basis is influencing police leaders to do the most analytically data-driven and justified kind of approaches to making police decision-making. So in a great sense, we do have a leadership capacity and maybe an informal capacity. But as time moves forward, I think we're starting to recognize that there's more valuable skill sets than simply police experience and street knowledge. There's plenty of highly educated civilian staff that come into policing, and they've got plenty of additional skill sets that are valuable in contemporary policing. You know, I'm thinking things like business and accounting, et cetera, et cetera. Like all of those types of skill sets are very valuable for 21st century policing. So if we start moving away from recognizing the value that people have, not just based off of their rank, but on the role that they have in the police service, I feel as though analysts have a very, very strong leadership role that they could potentially have. And in terms of like justifying some of that stuff, again, that's in the book that I've got. But individuals, former police officers, analysts, individuals who have been associated with crime analysis as a whole have been vouching for a number of years that analysts have an informal leadership capacity that I feel like we're not really tapping into. And I feel as though, especially with evidence-based policing and recognizing that analysts have such a key role in ensuring that we've got evidence-based practices and evidence-based justifications for what we're doing within policing, we definitely have an informal leadership role moving into the future.
And I'll add, to mimic John's practice of being a student of research, studying what else is going on beyond the walls of your police department. So good stuff, John. Looking forward to that book coming out.
Sounds good.
All right. So last section we're going to talk about is personal interests. And you are a father of twins. Yeah. And toddlers, right? They're only about 2.5.
Yeah, they are. They're definitely keeping us busy.
Oh, man. So yeah. Boys, girls, one of each?
One of each. Yeah, we're very fortunate that way. Yeah, they keep us busy on our toes. And it's definitely a really, really good balance to come home to a family that, you know, I absolutely love and changes up the day-to-day pace that you have working in law enforcement. I think one thing people don't recognize is that analysts aren't necessarily, you know, out on the street, but we are impacted by what we can do and what we can't do within law enforcement. And many police officers would recognize the trauma and the experience that they have to go through. And I'm not taking away from that whatsoever. They've got some of the hardest jobs in the world, but our analysts also need to take care of their own mental health as well. And I know that some folks who are recognizing the importance of ensuring good mental health within policing as a whole recognize civilian staff as needing to prepare themselves and to take care of themselves. So I've definitely got that great balance to have a great family to take care of. So yeah, my little ones keep me on my feet, but always put a smile on my face at the end of the day. So.
Yeah. So at 2.5, they're just developing their little personality and obviously as twins. I actually have my stepbrothers were a set of twins and I have nephews that are twins. I have nieces that are twins. So I grew up and have experienced twins. So it's fascinating to me because they're not growing up by themselves. They're growing up with their brother or sister right beside them. So it's always that constant rivalry of twins, right? I'm sure you're seeing that by now.
Yeah. And it's relative to like other families who have two or more kids. It's different because if you've got kids that are separate from differences in ages, like you could hopefully expect like one of them to be a little bit more manageable than the younger one. But to have two of them at the exact same time, it's double the trouble, as some people say, but double the joy, I would say for sure.
Excellent. Well, our last segment of the show is Words to the World. This is when I give the guest the last word. John, you can promote any idea that you wish. What are your words to the world?
I would say for police leaders to identify how they go about using their analysts and what the expectation is, because they technically could have their analysts doing really mundane tasks, or they could really have their analysts excel. It's really up to the leadership in terms of what culture they want to end up creating. And one question that I would have for anyone who's interested in developing more data-driven and evidence-based intelligence-led types of approaches to their police agency is identifying what research culture they're really willing to push forward for in their police agency and whether or not research and intelligence really matters to them, or whether or not it's just a label or it's some catchphrase that they really want to go towards, because it's a lot more work than just saying those keywords. So.
Well, very good. Well, I leave every guest with you've given me just enough to talk bad about you later.
Sounds good.
I do appreciate you being on the show, John. Thank you so much. And you be safe.
Thanks, Jason.
Thank you for joining us today on Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. We hope you not only enjoyed the show, but also learned something new. For more information on our guests and information relating to today's topic, please visit our website at leapodcast.com. Special thanks to The Rough and Tumble for our theme song. For more of their music, you can visit their website at theroughandtumble.com. Also, thanks to Kyle McMullen for our show logo. For more of his design, please visit his website at moderntype.com. The show is hosted, recorded, and edited by Jason Elder and written by me, Mindy. You can contact us both via the LEA podcast website. Please join us again next time as we interview another expert in this great field.